Welcome with us for this second oral argument today, the Manitowoc Lincoln High School class. Would you please stand? Oh, we're delighted to see you all. You may be seated. The high school students are here with us with a national award-winning program called Court with Class. That is sponsored by this court and the Wisconsin State Bar Association. Students are invited, and if they accept the invitation, they've gotten copies of your briefs. They may have done other activities than reading the brief, and they come to the court, listen to oral argument, and then meet with a justice after this second oral argument. Everyone is invited to meet with the justice, also with the class, and the discussion will be on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in this case. So let me introduce the court to you all. I'll start on my far left with Justice Lewis Butler. Justice Butler is the justice with whom you're going to meet this afternoon. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. And to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With these introductions made, I'll call our second case 04-0740, Progressive Northern Insurance Company versus Richard P. Romanchek. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Romanchek is Tamara Hayes O'Brien. Ms. O'Brien, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. As you indicated, I'm Tamara O'Brien. I represent Richard Romanchek and his quest to recover uninsured motorist benefits. Very briefly, in December of 2002, Richard Romanchek was driving his motorcycle on a Florida highway when an unidentified station wagon cut him off with an illegal left-hand turn. In trying to avoid the collision, Mr. Romanchek lost control of his motorcycle and skidded down the road. He suffered severe and permanent injuries. The station wagon took off, but there is no dispute over Mr. Romanchek's account of the accident. Section 632.32 requires that every policy of insurance issued in Wisconsin include uninsured motorist coverage to protect an insured who's legally entitled to recover damages from an uninsured driver. What qualifies as an uninsured motor vehicle is not defined in the statute, except that it does indicate that an uninsured vehicle also includes an unidentified motor vehicle involved in a hit-and-run accident. The Progressive Northern policy that was issued to Richard Romanchek has to comply with the statutory mandate of coverage. The question in this case is whether the policy provision in the Progressive policy that requires physical contact through the definition of a hit-and-run vehicle as one which strikes the insured or the insured's vehicle is enforceable, or whether it is unenforceable because it narrows the coverage mandated by the statute.
Counselor, didn't we look at the same statute and decide in 1983 that it required physical contact? And tell me, what's different about your case that we ought not just stick with our past precedent on this statute's interpretation?
The court did render a decision in 1983 in the Hain decision case, in which it found that the hit-and-run phrase in the statute requires physical contact. The court has already rendered two decisions since that time that undermine the rationale and the basis for the Hain decision and essentially take the hit out of hit-and-run. And we submit that the majority's interpretation of the hit-and-run phrase in the statute in the Hain case is too narrow to effectuate the intent of the legislature in mandating uninsured coverage and to carry out the purpose of the statute.
But, Counselor, Counselor, in 1983 we decided it needed physical contact when we interpreted this statute, and the legislature hasn't changed the statute. Shouldn't we interpret that silence as their agreement with that interpretation?
I don't think that is the way it should be interpreted. The legislature didn't change the statute even after this Court rendered its decisions in Smith and Theis either. And what's unique about this case is that in enacting the amendment to the statute to include the hit-and-run phrase, the Court specifically noted that it was not going to define that phrase, leaving the interpretation to the courts. And in doing so, having accepted the invitation, if this Court determines, as I believe the history of the statute and the interpretation of it will show, that the Hain decision was too restrictive and was wrongly decided, then there's nothing that stops this Court from modifying its decision.
Well, don't Smith and Theis both require physical contact?
They require physical contact of a sort, but what was at what the Court decided in Hain was that the physical contact had to be direct contact between the unidentified vehicle and the insured's vehicle. In Theis, the unidentified vehicle did not physically hit the insured's vehicle at all.
No, but there was allegedly at least a piece from that vehicle, from the unidentified vehicle that hit the other vehicle.
There was a truck part that was propelled into the windshield of the insured's vehicle.
So there was physical contact.
And the Court found that that satisfied the physical contact requirement. But since it was not even clear from that case whether that was a piece of the unidentified vehicle or if it was just a piece of highway debris that was laying and was propelled.
Is there any physical contact in your case?
There's no physical contact in our case.
Let me ask you something else, if I might, that's been troubling me. The motorcycle involved here is owned by a person who's a resident of Wisconsin, but he has a condo in Florida, as I understand it. Is the vehicle, the motorcycle, normally kept in Florida?
It's my understanding that it's normally kept in Wisconsin, and the insurance policy here does have a provision that says that it is controlled by the law of the state listed in the insurance application, which is Wisconsin.
So we don't in any way get into the Florida no-fault provisions?
I don't believe so.
All right.
I believe that argument was advanced at the circuit court, and it wasn't pursued further.
Yeah, I followed the arguments that were at the circuit court level, but my concern was where the vehicle is normally kept, and you're telling me it's normally kept in Wisconsin.
That's my understanding.
Thank you.
So in the Theis decision, there wasn't direct physical contact between the two vehicles. There was a truck part. It may or may not have come from the unidentified vehicle. What really seems to have driven the Court's decision in that case, though, is that the objectives of the statute were satisfied. The insured was then entitled to recover benefits to the same extent they would have been able to recover them from the unidentified vehicle. The insured's reasonable expectations arising out of the statutory grant of coverage in circumstances where damages caused by an uninsured vehicle were satisfied, and there were no concerns of fraudulent claims in that case. Then, in the Smith decision, there was, again, no physical contact at all between the unidentified vehicle and the insured's vehicle, not even a part of the vehicle. In that case, an unidentified car swerved into a third car, which hit the insured. And the Court again found that the physical contact requirement was satisfied in that case.
What seems to be consistent is the hitting, whether it's a part, a piece of ice. I could imagine if a piece of plywood flies off a truck and it hits the car, that would be covered. But the consistency has been hitting, striking, collision, some object. This case has none of that. So you're asking us to go beyond, and then you're saying is that, well, and no one objects. In other words, I have witnesses, and I assume that's true. No one objects to the legitimacy of this. And then the problem will be, well, now, just let us get to a jury on this, one way or the other. I'm talking about for all cases. Well, you're saying that the public policy that this state has is inappropriate, right?
I'm saying that the interpretation that was rendered in Hain to require physical contact does not effectuate the intent of the statute to provide coverage whenever an insured can sustain its burden of proving that it would have been entitled to coverage from the unidentified vehicle. And it's an arbitrary distinction, and I think it's when bright-line rules like physical contact appear to be arbitrary and appear not to work as well as anticipated, that the courts start to graft exceptions and modifications, as the courts did in Smith and in the Thies decision.
But when you say I was here for at least one of those decisions, I think that the issue still is that there was a striking, a collision, a hitting. That's the point.
This reminds me. I'm sorry, Justice Bradley. That's right. This reminds me of cases that you wouldn't allow negligent infliction of emotional distress unless there was a physical damage, physical injury. This all started because, at least essentially started because you were afraid of fraud and you couldn't show emotional distress, but if you had a slight touching, you know, of any sort, it was good enough. And it seems to me you've got an uphill fight here because you've got a case that's directly against you, right?
That's correct.
And you're, we'd have to overturn Hayes, right?
You would. And, you know,
and you're, if I read your brief correctly, and I'll say it, you're too polite, that the cases afterwards on the propelling the object, et cetera, they adjust techniques to get around Hayes. I mean, it's just really, the court's looking for anything that touches. I mean, if you got a heavy wind, maybe that's going to be good enough as a result of this car riding down the highway and it creates a heavy wind and the wind knocks over this motorcycle. Maybe that would be good enough. And that, so your real objection is that these just don't really sit well with Hayes.
And they don't, because if you look back at the rationale in the Hain decision and the conclusion that the hit-and-run phrase in our statute is unambiguous and it plainly requires physical contact, it just isn't supported, Your Honor.
Not with the car that, or truck that's gone.
I'm sorry?
There's no physical contact with the car or truck that is gone, that has run. That's your point.
And what's happened, what's really striking about, for example, the miss and run cases that have been considered in this case, is that even though the primary objective of this physical contract rule is to avoid fraud, in every single one of those cases, there was no dispute about the insured's account of the accident. There were witnesses. Nobody had any fraud concerns, and these people were denied uninsured motorist benefits because of the fortuity of being able to avoid physical contact and collision when an unidentified vehicle causes an accident. And I think if you look back at the history...
Why isn't this a situation where if the law is to be changed, it should be changed by the legislature, not by this court? After 23 years of precedent in this court, precedent that has never been addressed, as I understand it, by the legislature, isn't this the legislature's job?
I think this is a unique circumstance because the legislature essentially invited the courts to interpret this phrase. If you look back at, you know, the legislature...
We interpreted it 23 years ago in Hain.
You did. And then the court, and you've modified it since then.
Well, but still we've said physical contact is required.
You did. But in Johnson Controls recently also, you recognized that where you became convinced that you hadn't properly analyzed the term damages in relation to environmental cleanup costs under the federal statutes, there's nothing that prevents you as the highest court from reconsidering your decisions and even overruling erroneous and outdated decisions.
Well, certainly you picked a good example where we did that. So.
I think you should.
What you're saying, this is the functional equivalent of a strike? Oh, that's just an insight.
I must not be inside. I don't get it.
I suppose one could do a Westlaw Alexa search to see the number of times that the court has had a statute, interpreted it. Legislature doesn't do anything, and the court reinterprets it. It probably been several such cases, and several such cases where the court refuses to reinterpret it. I don't know if you've done that, and then can figure out why the court does it sometimes and doesn't do it other times. I mean, that's the key. So what's your answer to the key and lock?
I have not done that type of search, but I do believe, as in Johnson Controls, that when the court has interpreted, rendered a decision, and in this case did so at the invitation of the legislature, and subsequently decides that it was just wrongly decided, that the court does have the authority to correct its past errors.
You're saying this statute is unlike maybe others where you've got a deliberate attempt by the legislature, which is acknowledged that it's an ambiguous phrase. The legislature says leave it to the courts. It doesn't say leave it to the courts once, does it?
No, it says leave it to the courts always. If there's the legislature implicitly acknowledged that this is an ambiguous phrase, not an unambiguous phrase. And the law and the facts support that as well. I mean, the legislature added the hit-and-run provision to the uninsured motorist statute after this court's 1969 decision, in Midcheck. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that quite properly, but in that case, the insurance policy extended coverage for hit-and-run vehicles, but expressly defined hit-and-run vehicles as those causing damages through physical contact with the insured or the insured's vehicle.
Ms. O'Brien, do you think that a distinction between Johnson Controls and this particular situation is the length of time involved? In Johnson Controls, I can't remember exactly, but it seems to me it's about 5 or 6 years after Edgerton that we decided Edgerton was wrongly decided. This has been an interpretation that's been there for 23 years and has been repeated in a number of cases, not only from this court, but from the Court of Appeals. Now, doesn't that give us a valid distinction?
I don't think it does. I mean, the Court of Appeals, of course, is mandated to follow your rulings, and I think in the Daynell's decision, you know, the last line in that decision is, we are compelled to follow the Wisconsin Supreme Court's physical contact rule. And in that case, where there was only, it was ice that fell into the windshield and caused injury, the court concluded that the contact requirement wasn't met. But I don't think there's anything magical about the passage of time, and particularly when you're construing language, because language is not static. And there have also been significant trends in other jurisdictions developing the majority rule that the physical contact requirement simply doesn't serve the purposes, the public policies underlying the mandate of uninsured coverage.
A close majority rule, aren't we talking, if I understand what I gathered from your brief correctly, you got 27 states on one side, 20 states on the other side, and 3 that have been fortunate enough not to address the issue. Is that correct?
I believe that is the status, but of those, the vast majority, and I don't recall the exact number, of those decisions adopting or changing to eliminate the physical contact rule, have been more recent. So the trend is toward the no physical contact rule. And this Court certainly is not obligated to follow other jurisdictions. But the fact is that I think those decisions that do not base benefits, the availability of benefits, on the arbitrariness of a physical contact, whether that happened or not, are the better reasoned decisions.
Counsel, let's say, hypothetically speaking, that we are absolutely wedded to stare decisis. Absolutely wedded to stare decisis. We will not alter our past precedent. So let's look at past precedent, Thies and Smith. Those two unanimous decisions set out a consistent framework of interpretation. And let's say we say, okay, you know, stare decisis, we are obligated to follow the analytical framework of our two most recent cases in this area. And so that analytical framework, whether or not you look at Thies in paragraph 10 or other paragraphs, or Smith, which has the same analytical framework as this, it says the question, and I'm paraphrasing, the question of whether or not 632.32.4 requires coverage in this instance isn't decided by looking at the policy. In fact, we don't even look at the policy. The policy is irrelevant, said two unanimous recent cases. But what we look at is the public policy, the three, I think it is, or maybe four, three underlying public policy figures. And both of our recent unanimous cases said that's our analysis. So take us through our analysis, if you will. Why does the public policy require or not require coverage under this statute?
And that's precisely what we would urge the Court to ultimately conclude, is that this is a determination, whether benefits are available, that should be determined by the public policies and whether those are satisfied.
Okay.
The Court has acknowledged that those objectives are threefold. One, you want to provide the insured with coverage in those circumstances where the insured would otherwise be entitled to recover from the unidentified vehicle. And two, you want to make sure that the reasonable expectations of the insured arising out of the statute's promise of coverage whenever damage arises from an unidentified vehicle will be provided. And three, you want to do both of those things with some reasonable assurances against fraudulent claims. In this case, Mr. Romant, and in every case where the insured carries the burden of proving these things, Mr. Romanchak would have been, had this station wagon stopped, would have been able to assert a claim for negligence and damages against the driver of that station wagon. So granting uninsured motorist benefits satisfies the first objective. Second, the accident and the injuries arose out of the other driver's operation of what constitutes an uninsured and unidentified vehicle. So the reasonable expectations of coverage are satisfied.
Well, so, Brian, let me stop you right there. When we're talking about the reasonable expectation of the insured, isn't it significant here that the policy itself, the insurance policy at issue, requires a striking? That's the language that's in the policy. How can you read that and say that the reasonable expectation of the insured would have been recovery?
To the extent we make the assumption that the insureds read their policies, we also have to assume they are aware of the statutes as well. And the statute mandates a particular type of coverage regardless of the language of the insurance policy. I think Justice Spradley just...
But should the insured also be then aware of the case law in Wisconsin that's been in effect for 23 years?
And the departures therefrom, yes. And I think the trend is toward looking at what the objectives and the public policies underlying the statute are and seeing if those are satisfied.
Mr. Brian, if I were If I were to buy a motorcycle and think of taking a trip to Florida and was concerned about this kind of a scenario, is there any insurance coverage I could get to protect myself?
I don't know that there is any insurance that would cover your damages other than your first-party property damage or medical expense coverage, which is usually very limited, $1,000 or so. I'm not aware of any.
Counsel, so if you went to a state that had uninsured motorist coverage, if this is what Justice Prosser is asking you, and this policy said, got to have a hit and run, couldn't recover? Do you know what we're talking about? You buy a policy in Wisconsin. The policy in Wisconsin says you got to have a collision. Now you're going to another state, and that state has a statute that's been interpreted that you don't have to have a collision.
As Florida's, yeah.
Florida. So you get hit in Florida. Oh, I'm sorry, you don't get hit. You missed in Florida. So now you want to get your uninsured motorist coverage. Does the policy have a provision about conflict of laws?
It does not. It has a provision that indicates that it will be construed under Wisconsin law in this case.
So you're not insured. He wouldn't be insured if it was in Florida.
I understand the purpose of those provisions to be so that the coverage doesn't vacillate as you cross state lines.
Counsel, how does that, these questions about what does the policy say, fit in with paragraph 27 of the Smith opinion written by Justice Babbage, which says, with regard to expectation, it says, the public policy purpose of honoring the reasonable expectations of the insured is applied when the language of an insurance contract is interpreted and construed. The question to be decided here, however, here, that is, the earlier discussion talks about unique in 632-34 cases. The question to be cited here, however, is not the construction of the policy, but what the law requires. Thus, the reasonable expectation of the insured regarding the language of the policy is not relevant to our analysis for a 632-632 claim. How does that all tie in? That language, by the way, is found in the Tees opinion also, the same thing.
I think the answer is that the language of the statute also gives rise to reasonable expectations. The statute mandates uninsured motorist coverage to the same extent as the insured would have been able to recover had the driver been insured. And those statutory provisions are both by law and by the terms of the insurance policy incorporated into the policy. And that's where the reasonable expectations come from.
Now, in these other states that have interpreted these provisions to be a miss and run, are they interpreting the policy? Are they interpreting a state statute, or are they saying as a matter of public policy under the state statute, or contrary to the policy, you got to cover it?
It is a mixed bag, but most of the cases that have statutes that include hit and run, and even those are they focus on the statutory language primarily.
Thank you. Ms. O'Brien, your time has sped by, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Robert Lauer, representing Progressive Northern Insurance Company.
May it please the Court, Counsel, good morning. I am Rob Lauer, and I represent Progressive Northern insurance company in this case. Patty Kurth from our office is also present in court.
That is the same company as in Hain.
Judge, there's a strange twist of coincidences. County case, our firm handled it for Progressive in 1983. Waukesha County case now, our firm is handling it. But most importantly, Patty Kurth did the briefing in 1983, but she was only 7 years old at the time.
Is there an affidavit on file for that fact?
I believe it.
In my analysis of this case, I think that the issue really is, in the absence of fraud, should the statute in question be overturned, should it be changed so as to not require physical contact? And I think the quick answer is no. And I must say from the outset, I am not unaware of the consequences of that decision, that there is no coverage and you have a Wisconsin citizen who is in Florida and theoretically will not be able to seek damages or be compensated for his injuries. But, as happens often in the law, there is a line drawn. Some people fall on one side of the law, some people fall on the other.
Well, Mr. Lauer, if I can ask you, because having spent 12 years hearing traffic or criminal misdemeanor cases and getting the view of hit and run from a different perspective than the one I think that most of the people here have, let me ask you, because there's another side of hit and run. There's the side of hit and run that's charged in for traffic violations, that's charged for criminal violations. It's defined in sections 340, 667, 68, and 69 of the Wisconsin statutes. And at least two of those statutes, the statutes involving duty upon striking a person in an intended or occupied vehicle, and the ones involving striking property on or adjacent to highway, do not have a striking component. They talk in terms of a vehicle involved in an accident. Now, what I'm trying to understand is, at least for some consistency within the law, why should the interpretation of hit and run for civil liability be different than for criminal or traffic liability?
Well, I think that statute you talked about, I think, was analyzed in the Hain case and uses an example of the word strike being used. Interestingly, that statute has not changed at all since that time, as we know has happened in Hain. And I think that is acquiescence of the legislature's approval of what this court did in Hain in 1983. It's an interesting progression. You've got a statute, an uninsured statute, being analyzed in 1969 by the Midzich case, and they looked at the policy language there and found that the policy said you need a hit. The statute didn't prohibit that, and so the court said we feel you need physical contact. But that case opened, I think, extended an invitation to the legislature to make a move if they didn't agree with that. And in my view, what happened in 1979, 632 was created. The legislature took that offer and, in fact, put in this phrase now, expanding what an uninsured vehicle is. It's an unidentified vehicle involved in a hit and run. So that brings us to Hain, who's asked to interpret that. And the Hain court said, this is unambiguous. A hit means a hit. It does not mean a miss. And I disagree with counsel's interpretation of Hain. It didn't say you need direct contact. It said you need physical contact. And I also disagree with their position in the brief that there's been an erosion of that premise over the years. I don't think there has been. We've had near-miss cases analyzed, and we've had hit cases analyzed, but what has been consistent since Hain is there is a requirement for a hit.
What arguably has been eroded is another part of the equation, that is that the unidentified vehicle hit Yes or no? I mean, when I think of the Smith case, the involving the three-party collision, it was the third vehicle that sped away that was unidentified, but what hit was the identified vehicle.
I don't know if there's been an erosion. I think there's been a progression.
Okay, well, yeah, I think that's much better. I like to progress rather than erode. So why shouldn't we progress on that part of the definition as you framed the issue? And I like the way that you framed the issue from the get-go. Essentially it is, I can't do it any better than you, but you focused on the prong dealing with fraud, and the arguments advanced in part are, should there be a narrow exception carved out when there is, when as here, there is no assertion of fraud on behalf of the insurance company or any acts, colorable acts that would suggest fraud. So that's, it sounds like that's at least one of the arguments when the public policy, the third public policy component, which is preservation of fraud, which you hit on in your issues, why shouldn't, when there's no suggestion of fraud, no one's claiming it, nothing would cause anyone to put that forward, why shouldn't there be an exception?
Justice Bradley, because I don't believe that fraud is what drives the decision in this case, or should drive the decision. I think fraud is irrelevant to what we're faced with, and that is the Hain decision, which is good law. With all due respect to Justice Abrahamson's dissent, that is the law coming out of a case where they said hit means hit.
Mm-hmm.
And
why shouldn't I progress from that?
Well, we can progress, but I think it's a legislative function. It is not the role of this court, in all due respect, to rewrite the law, especially in light of the invitation that Justice Abrahamson extended to the legislature in 1983. And she said, it may be too late for Mr. Hain, but please do what you can, or take up the majority's opinion and give us something. And what has happened, the legislation has not done anything. Interestingly, over the course of 22 or 23 years, that statute has been amended or worked on in four different occasions, but that specific section involving the unidentified vehicle has never been changed.
But Mr. Lauer, if I could, yes. I understand your point, but this is one of those rare instances, and I don't think it happens often, where the legislature actually left it up to the court. If you look at the Legislative Council note from 79, a precise definition of hit and run is not necessary for in the rare case where a question arises, the court can draw the line. Sounds like they said that we're to make that determination.
But the decision was made, the determination was made in 1980.
That part I understand. That part of your argument I understand. But I'm not sure regarding your argument that now the legislature has to move. They seem to have said, we'll leave it up to the courts to figure this area out.
Well, I guess my point is that decision was made in 1983, and it's been made in subsequent cases where, interestingly enough, the Hain decision has been embraced or at least accepted, including the Smith case and the Theis case, where there's been acknowledgement of the requirement for physical hitting.
You think those two cases are really true to the Hain case,
yes,
or is it a movement away? Because Hain stands for the proposition that the vehicle, the runaway vehicle hit, and this, the vehicle was nowhere in sight, never hit him. We never knew where the debris was in the Theis case.
In Hain, there was no contact. That was a miscase.
That's right. But there was no contact in the other cases either between the two vehicles. A part of a vehicle, maybe. One never knew. Maybe the highway department dropped that piece of the equipment on the road. You don't know where it came from.
We do know, though, that it was a part of a vehicle, which is...
It was a vehicle being transported.
on the back of a truck.
Well, to that extent, you're correct. We do not know where the piece came from.
And that was confessed, fessed up, in the opinion.
It was, but the underlying premise from the Hain case was you need a hit in order to be a hit-and-run vehicle, and that has been consistently applied. And what's interesting is in the Donnell case, which Justice Robinsack authored, that did not follow. There was a hit with a piece of ice, I think it was, but it wasn't part of the integral part of a vehicle, a motor vehicle, so coverage was not applied in that case.
You think that's consistent with Tice?
Well, I do, because I think there is a distinction between a part of a motor vehicle and something that happens to come off of a motor vehicle, or, I mean, what's the logical stopping point? As you said, Justice, maybe the wind will be the next hit mechanism, and you'll get uninsured coverage for that.
If a truck was carrying these parts, automobile parts, and one fell off the truck, and then ultimately I hit it and it flew up into my windshield and caused me damage, is that like ice?
No. I think that's consistent with Theis, that if the nexus is motor vehicle and there is a leaf spring, albeit brand new, being transported, that is the connection and that there is now physical contact and therefore the Hain requirement is met.
So if a refrigerator fell off the truck and I hit the refrigerator, I don't collect uninsured motorist coverage. But if there's an unidentified piece of a car and I hit that, I do collect. Does that make any sense?
Well, it does in light of the Hain decision, I think.
Well, then you have to say, does the Hain decision make any sense?
Well, I think the fundamental reality is it brings us back to what the Hain court did. And they analyzed that and required contact. And it is not, again, with all due respect, it's not this court's decision to rewrite the statute.
That's the issue.
It's not.
If you put it that way, I'm going to have to agree with you. It's not this court's prerogative to rewrite a statute. If you're going to say, can the court change its statutory interpretation when it thinks its statutory interpretation was wrong, then I have to say it is the court's prerogative. And I probably, if I go through the cases, can find at least a dozen.
But I think you then have to analyze why. Why would you do that? And counsel has made reference to this trend that's going on nationally. I think if you look at those cases and look at the annotations, there's an allegation that there are 27 states that now find the Hain rationale impermissible and against public policy. There may be a kernel of truth in the fact that there are now 27 states that don't require physical contact. But if you look at that closely, what has happened is those courts are now interpreting statutes that either don't require physical contact or don't have the word hit or hit-and-run vehicle in them. And our position is, we did look at those statutes, and actually out of the 27, six have legislation providing that physical contact is not necessary where there is corroborative evidence. That's a different statute than we have in 632.32. Nine states out of that 27 don't use the word hit-and-run or hit-and-run vehicle. Again, that's different than what we have in 632. There's one state that evidently doesn't require physical contact if it's promptly reported. But that gets back to my underlying premise is the legislature is the body that should be rewriting the statute. And if the court is unhappy with that, then the invitation could be extended again, hopefully in a dissent, to analyze the statute and change public policy. You know, there's this reference to public policy and public policy demands that. My view is that public policy is manifested in laws. The law in Wisconsin has been consistent for 23 years, and the legislature has chosen not to change that law.
How many bills went to the legislature to change this law?
632 has been dealt with.
No, but I mean this provision of the law.
None.
So how do we know what their legislative intent was? They keep changing, too. It's not the same people that were there 27 years ago, or whatever the number is.
Well, I think we're making
a presumption, and it's one that we make in the cases, but it's a fiction.
But isn't it also a presumption if the court presumes now that the public policy doesn't require physical contact anymore because you've got no fraud? Isn't that something that's better left to a legislature that will have public hearings and theoretically be the voice of the people and making
the
decisions?
The court says the legislature left an ambiguous statute. We know a lot of statutes are ambiguous, but this one, they said it was ambiguous. The whole legislative council, this is all part of the insurance code. They were working for 10 or 12 years, right?
Correct.
And you have extensive notes on this Blue Ribbon Committee that worked on this insurance code. And they said, man, you got a little problem here because we don't know what hit and run means. But let's not spend our valuable time deciding that. We can leave it up to the court and let's move on. That's what they did. So the court has been, as always, delegated the power to interpret the law. The only difference in this one is it's a stated delegation. But it doesn't have to be stated, but this one makes it easier. So then the court says, as it said in Johnson, and it says in numerous cases, that was what the statute said. That's what we thought the legislature intended by its plain meaning of the words. But time shows that that's not quite right. So we now say, blah. And if the legislature doesn't like it and if Progressive doesn't like it, it can go to the legislature and get it changed. Now, Progressive, you're a member of the Insurance Alliance?
Yes. I believe so.
You believe so. If not, you're going to join it because it can go to the legislature and has the resources to get the legislation changed. But Mr. Hain is not going to do that. He's already injured. He's done with it. He doesn't think that lightning is going to strike twice. So he's not going to go to the legislature, right? I mean, there's no alliance of uninsured motorists, right?
True.
So you don't have anybody going to the legislature for them, right?
Well, I mean, in theory you don't, but practically what's to stop Mr. Romanchuk, if in fact there is a decision against him, to take up a grassroots campaign and contact his legislatures and say, you know what, this law is unfair, things have changed nationally, and Wisconsin maybe should take another look at it. But he's working through the legislature rather than using the Supreme Court to decide a case that has worked well for 22 years.
Well for whom?
Well, I think it's worked well for this state. There are going to be some cases where people are excluded. But by
could I ask a question here? Would this have any effect on insurance premiums if people can recover without any proof that there was another vehicle involved?
Absolutely it would. Absolutely, because the charge for UM coverage is based upon some of those instances.
How much is UM coverage?
Oh, Justice, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I shouldn't guess because I don't know. But it would go up, and I think if there is an exception created, it creates a whole set of different problems, namely, okay, what's an independent witness? Is my wife sitting next to me in the car an independent witness? What's corroborative testimony? I don't know. We've got a bright line now that, at least in my view, has worked well. There are some instances where perhaps injured Wisconsin residents aren't compensated, but because we want a just result in one case doesn't mean that the precedent of Hain is disregarded.
But what I'd like to know is, could the insurance purchaser have done anything to protect himself on these circumstances?
Because it was a, if that motorcycle is kept in Wisconsin and it's a Wisconsin policy, then whatever fact situation, either inside Wisconsin or outside Wisconsin, it's our view, Wisconsin law would control.
Mr. Lawler is saying that I want to buy insurance to protect myself in case some idiot is coming toward me and the only alternative is to drive in the ditch. Can I buy coverage for that?
Not in Wisconsin unless there is contact between you and the idiot that
there's
pulled me into the ditch.
No collision or nothing that will cover that.
Oh, I think there would be coverage for MedPay. There would be coverage for damage to the motorcycle. But the BI claim, as I understand it, would not be covered absent some element of physical contact consistent with what Haynes said. And, I mean, this policy was issued, I think, in 98 or 99 at a time when the law in Wisconsin clearly was you need physical contact between the unidentified vehicle and the insured vehicle in order to have coverage for UM.
Mr. Lawler, if I might follow up on Justice Prosser's question, my understanding is that if this vehicle is regularly kept in Florida, that you've got a totally different situation because Florida is a no-fault state. And if the vehicle is regularly kept in Florida, then there should be the purchase of a policy that would meet the Florida law. Is that not correct?
Well, to be honest with you, we did not get into the conflict of law analysis in the appellate court because that was dropped. But my thought that I was thinking was if this person is a snowbird and spends a lot of time in Florida and you want the benefit of Florida's no-fault situation, then perhaps it's a good idea to buy a Florida policy for that motorcycle.
But for the vast majority of these kids and their parents and their aunts and their uncles who live in Wisconsin, what's the answer? And don't happen to have another vehicle in Florida?
The answer is based upon Haynes' interpretation of that statute, you need physical contact, and there has been a consistent application of that rationale for 22 years.
Let me just try this once more. Certainly an insurance purchaser can buy uninsured motorist coverage with a certain interpretation and limitation to that coverage. But are you telling me that if you're my agent, I go to you and I say, I want to buy coverage not if I'm hit by an unidentified driver, but if I have to swerve off the road, you will not sell me any coverage for that?
As I understand it, in Wisconsin, and I can only speak for Progressive, because that's the policy I've been poring over these past months. In my understanding is, unless you have contact, there would not be coverage for a near miss.
Justice Prosser wants you to put on a special endorsement on your policy saying section so-and-so doesn't require hit and run. For him, we're writing a miss and run, and we're going to charge him Y number of dollars extra for this endorsement. And if you don't want to do it as an endorsement, he wants you to sell him another policy, which you might not have as a form policy, but there's no objection in the insurance commission for it, and he wants you to sell it, which says that. That's what I understand his question to be.
And the question is, can Progressive do that?
Yeah.
I don't know. My presumption is, if they could, there would be an increased premium, rightfully so. Because now you're covering more risks. But I think, the rationale of Progressive is, we have this statute, it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court, we're going to issue a policy that is in line with that statute and the interpretation, and that has been the law in Wisconsin for 22 years.
I'm going to try and approach Justice Price's question a different way. You are a foreign corporation. What states do you write policies in, and isn't there at least one state that says miss and run? So I want to give you a form, and I can even give you a, you know, an estimated premium because it's part of your experience. Now, we can account for population. We can account for a whole lot of things. Do you write any policies of miss and run outside of Wisconsin?
In states, I'm sure where there are states that don't require physical contact, that is done.
Progressive does business outside of Wisconsin.
Correct.
Okay. How many states do you know?
I don't know for
sure. But a lot.
I probably should know that, Justice, but I don't.
Okay.
Mr. So, Lawler, doesn't Progressive do business in Florida?
Progressive does.
In a no-fault state?
Correct.
In a state where there would be coverage for a miss?
Correct.
All right.
Correct.
You have a form policy.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, I don't know what happened to your lights. It is no reflection on your argument, Mr. Lauer.
Okay. I want to mention a couple things. One is, I think what you're being asked to do by Mr. Romanchuk is to carve out, you know, a small exception. Our interpretation of that is you're being asked, in order to do what you're being asked to do, you're going to have to overrule cases. You're going to have to overrule Hain. You're going to have to overrule Feiss. You'll have to overrule at least a part of Smith. And you'll have to overrule the Wagner case. And that is not easily done and not typically done, at least in my experience. There was one other point. And it was covered earlier. Just on a personal note, I was here, this is my second time here, I was here 10 years ago. I know I'm not any smarter than I was 10 years ago, but it's I consider it a privilege and an honor to appear before you. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your coming, Mr. Lauer, and I don't know if the court is any smarter or not either. So, I don't even know if we're the same people. From your perspective, I'm not any smarter. Ms. O'Brien.
I'd like to make a couple of points. I mean, the court, we're not asking the court to rewrite a statute. We're asking the court to change your interpretation of the statute, the phrase hit and run, because it is not, in fact, unambiguous. It's not unambiguous at all.
Brian, what about stare decisis, though? I mean, whether we might have decided the statute in that form or not originally, that has been the interpretation for the last 23 years. Mr. Lauer makes a valid point. We don't overturn decisions lightly.
No, we don't overturn them lightly. But when you also don't bury your head in the sand, and if you acknowledge that a decision was improperly entered.
And that's why I asked you about stare decisis. What has changed? What is different in the landscape that would cause a different interpretation today than that which was made when Hain was decided?
The difference is a changing jurisdiction and also changing language. I mean, hit and run right now, colloquially, you can be... You take a hit in the stock market. You can, see a Broadway hit. You can be hit on in a bar. You can, a criminal can hit by robbing you. And an uninsured vehicle can hit by causing an accident. Those are things that were not recognized in the Hain decision. As the dissent noted in Hain, dictionary definitions then and now include a hit-and-run vehicle as one that simply causes an accident and flees the scene without any physical contact at all.
Do we have to overrule Hain if we would accept your argument?
That's a very close question, I think, because it is a natural progression. Where else are you going to progress? You have progressed away from the requirement that there be a hit by the uninsured vehicle. The next step, the natural step, is that, okay, maybe we don't really need a hit anymore. What we need is to satisfy the objectives of the statute. And where there are no concerns about fraud, and where the insured wouldn't have been able to recover from a driver if that driver had been insured, there should be uninsured motorist coverage. And that should be the test for determining whether the insured has sustained its burden of proving that it should be entitled to recover damages from the uninsured driver.
So you're arguing, from what I hear, for a fraud exception to the Hain rule, or is that not what you're arguing? That's what I, when I was reading this stuff, that's what I thought you were arguing, but, and that's why I asked the question.
I don't think there's any question that you have to depart from the ruling in Hain that the statute, using the phrase hit and run, is unambiguous and requires physical contact. I'd love to point out that the court in Hain determined that the legislature intended to incorporate a class of coverage that was already included in most insurance policies. But the insurance policies did not just use the phrase hit and run. They used hit and run and defined it as a vehicle which strikes the insured's vehicle. And the physical contact came from the striking, not from the hit and run. And when the legislature then amended the statute to also include hit and run vehicles, it included the hit and run vehicle and expressly omitted the definition and the striking requirement. And then went another step beyond that and invited the courts to interpret the phrase. There's also, I propose, a disconnect between the objective of the statute in providing coverage and construing the hit-and-run phrase as one requiring physical contact. The rights of injured parties to recover damages from an uninsured driver are not contingent upon whether or not there's physical contact. And to apply that contingency when the driver flees is arbitrary and fortuitous. Mr. Romanchak was injured by an uninsured driver. No one disputes his account of the accident. There's no concern of fraud in this case or in any case where the insured carries its burden of proving that they're entitled to recovery. And we do ask that the court find that the hit-and-run phrase in WSSTAT Section 632.32 does not require physical contact, and that the provisions of the progressive policy that do require physical contact are unenforceable. I also note that the progressive policy, in fact, would not have been enforceable had it been at issue in the Smith case, because the progressive policy does require the hit-and-run vehicle to strike the insured's vehicle, and that didn't happen in Smith. So the policy has already, there are circumstances already where the policy is unenforceable.
Thank you, Ms. O'Brien. Thank you, Mr. Lauer, for more information about hit-and-run, miss-and-run, and uninsured motorist coverage. So that ends up hearing on 04-0740, Progressive Northern Insurance versus Richard P. Romanchak. We will be in recess until 1:30 for our last oral argument this week, and the students should remain here. Justice Butler will be out in a few moments to talk with you and anyone else who wishes to remain.